I think I say this every week, but I'm excited about what I'm going to talk about today. I hope you will be by the time we get through it all, but we're walking through, as you know, this series, What Does It Mean to Be a Christian? I hope this has been an encouragement so far. I've enjoyed walking through it and thinking through it. I'm excited for hopefully what comes from it and the things we're able to do because of it in an ongoing way. The last couple weeks, talked about the gospel and hopefully just, some of the fullness and richness of what that means and what that meant to people in the world of the first century and what that calls us to. And today we're going to pick up on that theme a little bit because one of the most significant things we read in the New Testament is this idea that we are saved by grace. And this word grace we see over and over and over again. It's just sprinkled all throughout the New Testament. And it's probably one of the most popular words in church names, in the country at least, probably in the world. It's a big deal in the Christian faith, but it's what also that also means it's one of those words that has a lot of ideas, or if we were, just like with the gospel, if we asked 100 people, what is the gospel, right? You would get a lot of different nuanced or perspective answers or different things that people have heard. And if we were to do that with the word grace, we would experience a similar thing. If you said, what does grace mean? You would get a lot of different interesting answers. Or people would maybe give some ideas of kind of what comes from grace, but they might struggle to really define grace itself. So I'm going to tell you today is going to be a little bit different. And maybe I say that more. I don't even know. Today's going to feel a little bit like, because I know we have a lot of highly intellectual, sophisticated moms in our church, academic, strong thinkers, okay? So my Mother's Day gift to you is going to be less of a sermon, and this is going to be, I'm just going to tell you guys, this is going to feel more like a seminary lecture, okay? We're going to talk about history and linguistics and all of those fun kinds of things and how they come together. But all of this is going to come together in a way that I hope we will walk away with just such a greater, deeper understanding of our God and Father, who is a God of grace, and of a gospel that is called the gospel of God's grace. So, if you've been in or around church for any amount of time, like I said, you've heard this word. You've probably heard people say a lot of things about grace. We know that we are saved by grace, but what does grace mean? What does it actually mean? Many of us, if we've been in church, if you've been in church for any significant amount of time, you've probably heard some kind of definition or the idea of grace being unmerited favor. That's a really popular one. Grace means it's all God. We have no part in the equation. He does everything. We've heard things like it is a free gift. All you have to do is take it. You guys are like, what is Kevin going to say today? you can become a Christian and you don't have to do a single thing. That's grace, right? These are just normal, common things that we hear often. We hear they're very, if you've been in church culture for a while. These are just normal things that people say. And it's kind of like, okay, yeah, that's what grace means. That's grace. So those are some of the kind of common definitions or ideas we hear that are pretty common. Now, also something interesting that happens over the centuries, we'll go ahead and pull up this. Over the centuries, we've developed some categories of grace as well. So not just definitions of grace, but different people in different parts of different times in church history, they've looked at scripture and they've said, okay, we can see how grace is kind of described and different ways that what we say is the grace of God, how it functions in different ways. And you may have heard of, or maybe you're seeing some of these for the first time and you're like, what? But we've developed these ideas about prevenient grace or irresistible grace or effectual grace, which irresistible and effectual are kind of the same thing, but different words for the same thing. Sanctifying grace, sacramental grace, and there's others. Some of these categories also, the majority of these, while theological categories and things like this can be helpful, it is important to remember that things like this were mostly developed in the 16th century, not in the first century. And even some of the categories that are maybe within the Protestant Christianity we're familiar with, or, you know, depending on your church tradition, even a lot of the categories that people like, so that's John Calvin down there on the right, on the bottom. On the left is a man named Thomas Aquinas, who was one of the leading Catholic theologians of the Middle Ages. And really, he was one of the people who started developing these categories of grace. And so what was happening in the Protestant Reformation was people who had been Catholic leaders started seeing what the Catholic Church was teaching, and the Catholic Church had these categories. And so they were saying, well, we think Scripture is really saying kind of this, so we're going to take these categories and we're going to create our own new categories that we think are better representatives of Scripture. And they started teaching about grace in a different way than the Catholic Church. But what didn't really happen, even during the Protestant Reformation, they never really went to the first century and said, what did grace mean to people living in the first century Greco-Roman world? You can read all of Calvin's Institutes and all of the Reformers, and they don't actually really go to that next layer. So when we want to understand what did grace mean to the people who wrote and received the books and letters of the New Testament, we have to kind of take that next step and say, okay, what did this actually mean in that world? And we need to go there before we can say, what does this mean for us? What does this mean for my life? What does it mean that I'm saved by grace? What did it mean to people in the first century? Not primarily, what did people in the 1500s say about grace? So the person who's up there on the top right is a man named Seneca, who was a Roman statesman and philosopher who was born in 4 BC, which is most likely the same year that Jesus was born. And he lived through the first century. He was a contemporary of Jesus. He certainly would have known who Jesus was. He was the personal advisor and mentor for the Emperor Nero, who was a really crazy guy. But he wrote about life and culture and society, and he wrote significantly about what grace meant in the world of the first century. He's not the only source for this, but he's a significant source that helps us understand what that actually meant to people then. So, for us to understand what grace really means, and again, all of this is going to build. Next week, we're going to go into a lot more passages of Scripture and show how this kind of comes out in more practical ways and even flesh out when we read, "You are saved by grace," and really bring this more to life. This one, we're just kind of digging. We're getting behind the scenes. We're getting beneath the surface into the foundational ideas here. So our primary source for information about grace needs to be further back. We're going into statues, okay? All right, so what did grace mean in the world of the New Testament? Grace was not primarily a religious word. It was not primarily a spiritual word. It was not primarily a theological word. Grace was a word that found its home within the ancient framework of patronage, benefaction, and reciprocity. Our friend Seneca here, he wrote this. Patronage, the giving and receiving of favors, grace, charis, he said, it is the chief bond of human society. The world of the first century, the Greco-Roman world of the New Testament, like we've talked about the idea of honor and shame, we see it on every page in the New Testament. This is another one of those foundational pillars of society in the first century that is still present in a lot of ways. If you know what it is and you know how to look for it, we still have it in our world today, but it's not as central for us in day-to-day life. But the idea of patronage was a central pillar of ancient Mediterranean society. The world of the New Testament was one in which this idea was an essential means of acquiring access to goods, to protection, to opportunities for employment and advancement. It was not only essential, but it was expected and publicized. You had markets where people could go and buy and sell goods, or people could make some of the things that they needed in day-to-day life, but no one person or household could produce or manufacture or guarantee everything that they needed for survival in the ancient world. For anything outside of the ordinary, you had to find the people who possessed those things, or the people who controlled access to those things, and you had to seek out their favor. Property, wealth, and power were concentrated into the hands of a few. They were the gatekeepers. And the way of accessing those goods was not through government. There were not central banks. You could not get loans. You could not get an insurance policy. You had to do all of these things through personal, relational connections with the people who could provide those things through patronage. This is how the world went round and round in this time. So seeking help and granting help was not regarded, also, this is key, this was not a one-time transaction. This is the main, probably the biggest thing we're going to take away from this. The granting of favor or the granting of grace, it created a bond and a relationship between the giver and the receiver. Let's go to this next quote here. This is another quote from Seneca. It's a little bit longer, but this is really, really significant. Seneca wrote this. He said, "I must be far more careful in selecting my creditor for a benefit, for a favor, for grace, than selecting my creditor for a loan. For the latter, if the person who's just giving me a loan, I shall have to return the same amount that I've received. And when I've returned it, I've paid all my debt and I'm free. But to the other, to the one from whom I receive a benefit, a favor, a grace, I must make an additional payment. And even after I have paid my debt of gratitude, the bond between us still holds. For just when I have finished paying it, I am obliged. I am obligated to begin again. And friendship endures." The language of friendship in the first century is also tightly interwoven into the fabric of this patronage system. When we read the word friend, or even often the term koinonia, fellowship, partnership, this was frequently used in this idea of patronage, which could also be done between equals, the exchange of mutual services. You have something I need, I have something you need. We have this bond now of back and forth mutuality. But certainly it was often from someone who was higher, extending this grace to someone lower. So this bond, this friendship, this relationship would be marked by the mutual exchange of goods and service. The patron, the giver, would often be available on an ongoing basis for assistance in the future. And the client, the recipient, would do everything in his or her power to enhance the fame and honor of the patron. Again, this is an honor culture. You've helped me. I'm going to tell everybody about how great you are and how you came to my aid in my time of need. And the recipient will remain loyal to the patron and provide reciprocal services on an ongoing basis. Another little minor point here, but this also connects to our present world. There were the major patrons and the lower people on the receiving end, but there was also a category of people who were called brokers. Or another word used for these people was mediators. These were people who connected people to another patron. We read in the New Testament that Jesus is the mediator between God and man. We're going to look at much more examples of this, but again, we still have these categories in people today, right? It's just like there's still all kinds of ways that this still happens in our world today that we can look to and we can kind of find them, but this was foundational and essential and central to the world of the first century. So we're going to go a deeper layer into this in a minute, but aside from this idea of personal patronage, And when we use that word today, or we it normally has a very negative connotation, right? If someone is like looking down on someone else or approaching someone else as if they have something or information you need, what do we say? It's like, don't patronize me, right? It's like, I can do this myself. I don't need anybody, right? But there was also a really big deal made about not just personal patronage, but public, the word there is benefaction. If a patron provided something for a city or a geographical region, things like people would put up big money for public libraries, buildings, temples, athletic arenas. These things were almost always funded by the extremely generous contributions of benefactors and patrons. This didn't create the same kind of personal bond or relationship as the personal patronage did, but the city or the recipients who benefited from this person's gift would have certainly held that person in very high regard. And usually these public patrons, this is why we have things like inscriptions on these ancient buildings with people's names on them, which again, we still do today. We inscribe company logos on skateboards, right? Who provide funding and patronage to the work that is going on here. All of these things, or statues of them, right? If you see a statue of someone in the ancient world, it's because they were either like royalty or they had contributed huge amounts of funding or resources for the good of the general public. So, grace. The word grace itself was understood as the foundation of all of this. Grace was the word that encapsulated the entire ethos of this system of patronage and reciprocity. If we were going to define grace in the first century, it has three aspects. And we could look at them here. I think that's going to be on the next one here. Three aspects of grace, or charis, is the word we have in the New Testament. Grace can be the disposition that someone has towards someone else. If I have a favorable disposition towards someone else, it means I am willing to grant them a favor. We read in Luke this week, this word favor comes up multiple times in the opening of Luke. Mary, you have found favor with God. You have found charis with God. He is going to do something for you. It can refer to the gift itself. In the New Testament, we see this word charisma. Now, today we use the word charisma that refers much more to a person's character or a quality about them. And grace can have that idea too, of even just charis as a personality trait would describe someone in the ancient world who is a good candidate to fit into this system, right? Someone who was characterized by charis would be someone who is like, okay, that's someone who's, they would be honored if that was said about them. But it can refer to the gift itself. And again, we have words, even in our present day, that draw on this kind of ancient idea, charity, charis. And then finally, it can refer to the actual response to the gift itself. The word Eucharist is a direct transliteration of Eucharisteo, which is the word all throughout the New Testament for giving thanks, gratitude, being grateful. We put a T in there, but really the word is graceful. Being grateful is responding with grace to something that you have received. These are the three aspects of grace. Now, grace usually was unmerited. Not always, but it usually was unmerited. There are certainly times, and we could read examples where even Seneca and others, Plutarch, they write about how people who are looking for those to show their grace or to benefit them, they're like, you want to look for people who have a reputation for gratitude. But they also say, like, you know, sometimes you might want to show grace to someone and, you know, make it a flyer, you know, and kind of see what they do. What do they do with it? But it was usually unmerited. However, that was not the driving focus of charis in the New Testament. The idea or the reality that it was unmerited, that was not really the point. We make that the main point when we usually think about or talk about grace today, but that would not have been the driving emphasis about grace in the first century. It would have just been like, well, yeah, it's unmerited. Like, yeah, I don't have to give anything to you. I choose to. We'll pick up on that thought in a moment. When we put all of this together, we see that the first century assumption and understanding of grace is that grace must be met with grace. A gift must be met with gratitude, at minimum. And there's even within, again, ancient culture, they had kind of divinities for everything. And so some of you may have even seen in Greco-Roman culture, you may have seen statues or paintings, but let's pull this up. There's lots of artistic renderings of it, but these are the three graces of ancient Rome. So these are goddesses, and I had to work really hard to find one that I could show in church, right? Because that was tough, okay? But this is what Seneca says about these. So we'll just leave the picture up here and I'll read this. Seneca says, "Why do the sisters hand in hand dance in a ring which returns upon itself? For this reason, that a benefit passing in its course from hand to hand returns nevertheless to the giver. The beauty of the whole is destroyed if the course is anywhere broken, and it has most beauty if it is continuous and maintains an uninterrupted succession." These are the three aspects of grace: the favorable disposition of the giver, the gift exchanging hands, moving from the giver to the receiver, and then the receiver completing that circle with an abundance of gratitude and loyalty and reciprocation. Seneca says, "They are young because the memory of benefits ought not to grow old. They are maidens because the benefits are pure and holy and undefiled in the eyes of all. Their robes are transparent because benefits desire to be seen," he says. So what does all this really mean? Grace to anyone writing or receiving the words and letters and books of the New Testament, when they read about the grace of God, they would have understood that grace is freely given, but it is not free. There is no such thing as an isolated act of grace. The modern idea of the pure gift that seeks no reciprocation is entirely foreign to the world of the New Testament. They would listen to some of the things we say about grace and they would be like, "You just take it?" You'd be like, "No." they would make a meal for you. They would invite you into their home and they'd be like, "Let me explain to you. You don't get it." Okay? And really, Simon is probably the one who understands this more than anybody. The pros and cons of it, right? Because some human culture can take this and right and turn it into something that becomes this weird kind of arm-twisting, expectation, strings-attached, manipulative kind of thing, right? Like, "I'm going to do you a favor and then," right? So anything can get weird when you involve humans in it, which is why a lot of cultures left this behind in the dust, right? Because they're like, "I don't want all these strings." In the world of the first century, the gift, the grace that achieves its purpose is the one that creates, solidifies, celebrates, and deepens relationships of trust, loyalty, and mutuality. Grace is freely given, but it is not free. And failure to show gratitude was classed as the worst of crimes. It was even categorized as sacrilegious and an offense of the gods, right? Because the three graces, they were divinities, right? So if you didn't show grace in the ancient world, it was like, well, you're an atheist, right? Which is also another one of the worst things you could be told in the Roman Empire, right? Because spirituality and religion was also woven into every aspect of life. I think I have a Seneca quote about that too. He said something about that. Did I put that on here? Yeah. Ingratitude, which when we see ungrateful in the New Testament, the word is akaristeo. Ungraceful. Ungrateful. Ingratitude, or being an ingrate, right? That just has a different vibe to it, right? You're an ingrate. Because it is really bad. He says it's something to be avoided in itself because there is nothing that so effectually disrupts and destroys the harmony of the human race as this vice. And on the other hand, a reputation for gratitude, I mentioned this or maybe implied it a moment ago, we talk about credit today, right? You have a good credit score. If a bank wants to loan you money for a mortgage or a loan, they're looking in, and they're saying, "What is your history of paying back your previous debts?" In the ancient world, that credit line was, "Do you have a reputation for reciprocating grace with gratitude?" You may not even have material resources to repay. You may be significantly under-resourced, but if you at least demonstrated from your life that you were a person of gratitude, that you responded with loyalty and proclaiming the goodness of your patron, they'd be like, "Okay." Like, that was it. That was the best credit line a person could have in the ancient world. Obviously, if a patron has resources, they're going to want to give it to the people who are, like, grateful, right? Not people who are entitled and angry and yelling at them. Like, okay, like, why would I give you something? Now, how is this gratitude expressed? We're going to go a little layer deeper in this. Just like there's three aspects of grace itself, there's really three elements of how gratitude, that third category of grace, is expressed. And even, well, yeah, let's go back to that, actually. It's just funny. Again, we look at the words for grace, words for thank you in different languages that come from Latin in particular. The Latin word is gratis. So obviously, we all know gracias, grazie. But even Portuguese, can you say it for me? Obrigado comes from the Latin obligare, which means I am obligated to you. I am obliged now to repay what you have done for me. That's what it means. So, three aspects of gratitude, though, in the ancient world. That's just kind of a fun bonus. One, gratitude for receiving a gift should be expressed. Seneca says, not merely in the hearing of the giver, but everywhere. You increase the fame of your patron. You tell everybody about it. Man, he's your guy. If you need fill in the blank, he was so good to me. He was so kind. He came to our aid. Public expression, unashamedly, increasing the fame of the giver is part of the proper return for a benefit. And a gift that one is ashamed to acknowledge openly in the hearing of all is a gift that a person should never take in the first place in the ancient world. If you took a gift that you were not willing to publicly proclaim to anybody about, you had no business accepting it in the first place. The second component is loyalty to the giver, even if it costs you. In the ancient world, patrons, people who had lots of resources, usually not all the patrons always got along. And they might have even had some enemies, right? Who knows? But a recipient of aid would be obligated to seek to advance the patron's interests in whatever way that they could. Again, they may not have had tons of resources, they may not have had as much clout or connections or networks, but whatever they could do, they would try to figure out how I can return some benefit to the one who assisted me with what I needed. Even if it costs me. Another quote. I don't have this up here. But Seneca says, if you wish to make a return for a favor, you must be willing to go into exile or to pour forth your blood or to undergo poverty or even to let your very innocence be stained and exposed to shameful slanders. I don't know what that means, for your innocence to be exposed to shameful slanders, but that's what he says. If you accept a benefit, he's like, you need to be willing to go to bat for your patron, even if it costs you. Even if it costs you everything. Which again, very much aligns with what we heard about the gospel and the invitation of Jesus. He wasn't messing around. The third expression of gratitude was a return of some tangible gift or service. Again, understanding this is not repayment. This is not settling the score. This doesn't mean I earned anything, but it's just me saying, I'm going to do everything in my power and in my creativity to find some way. I'm going to return this in some way that is just meaningful. If I can benefit you in any way possible, I'm gonna try to do it. Just out of a heart of abundance and out of a heart of gratitude. And that would signify my continued loyalty and commitment to the relationship that I now have with this person. So all of this creates a really interesting social dynamic or tension. And it's like, okay, this is kind of like, just like the three graces, this is kind of like a dance, right? It's like, okay, I'm giving and you're obligated to receive, but it's not earned. It's a favor, but I'm also obligated to repay it. So this is like a back and forth kind of thing. But here's how this worked. This is the working tension of grace. And again, there's quotes I could read and go through where they actually they say basically this. But this is it. The giver gives freely, expecting nothing. But the recipient is obligated to return the favor. It's one of those like secret rules of grace in the ancient world. We have these things today. It's like, this is just how this works. And they're not going into the details of explaining all of this in the pages of the New Testament because people already knew this. They didn't need to explain this in the New Testament because people already knew this is how this works, right? I expect nothing in return if I give a favor. That those resources, they're dead to me. They're gone. I'm not keeping track. That's the honor of patronage. That's the honor of being the giver. But the recipient, I'm never going to forget this. And I'm going to do everything in my power to return the favor and proclaim my loyalty to you and your honor and your fame and your goodness. The giver never mentions the gift again, but the recipient publicizes it as broadly as possible. How many times do we even see Jesus doing that, right? He's like, you don't even need to tell anybody about this. And they're like, I'm telling everybody because that's how it worked. Again, we read in Luke this week, Mary, you found favor with God. Grace, charis. What does she do? She's like, you tell me what to do and I'll do it. Anything. And then what's the next thing she does? She sings a song of gratitude and praise, and she proclaims the fame and the glory of God. The most beautiful song ever composed. Jesus calls Levi, the tax collector. What's the very next thing Matthew does? He hosts a banquet with all of the other tax collectors, all of the people who have resources and means and connections. Matthew becomes a mediator for Jesus' ministry. He's connecting the tax collectors to Jesus because Jesus has something that they need, and he's connecting Jesus to all of the regional tax collectors because they were likely having a ministry support raising dinner at Matthew's house. That's what was happening. And we'll close just with this last passage. We're going to look at a lot more passages, and again, build on this foundation next week. But this is just so beautiful. from Luke, which this may come up this coming week or maybe next week. I forgot to look. But in Luke 6, it's part of Luke's rendition of the Sermon on the Mount. And also, we see this a lot in Luke, especially. Luke makes a big deal about these social dynamics because who is Luke writing to? Luke is writing to a man named Theophilus, who was a Roman official who understood all of these dynamics. And Theophilus, who was likely the patron who funded Luke's writing of his gospel and the book of Acts. He put up the money to support Luke for the time and the travel and the resources he needed to put these books together. Writing a book in the ancient world was an incredibly costly endeavor. So it makes sense why these themes are woven explicitly throughout the Gospel of Luke, if you know that they're there. But he says this, if you do what is good, Jesus says, if you do what is good to those who are good to you, what credit is that to you? What charis is that to you? Even sinners do that. And if you lend to those from whom you expect to receive, what charis is that to you? Even sinners lend to sinners to be repaid in full. But I say to you, love your enemies, do what is good, and lend, expecting nothing in return. Then your reward will be great, and you'll be children of the Most High, for he is gracious to the acharisteo. God is gracious to even the ungrateful, the worst people ever. God is even gracious to them. So you be merciful, just as your Father also is merciful. That is grace. That is the New Testament understanding of grace. And as we follow that understanding and start to look at some more passages of Scripture through more of this lens, it's like, whoa. So we're going to do more of that next week. But this week, let's be graceful.